Let's go ahead and get started. So see if we can get started here. My name is Mark Perkins, and I am with Deepti Bora here. We are both second-year master's degree students in the International Educational Sciences Master's Degree Program here at the University of Jyväskylä, and we are really honored to be able to lead this discussion section after having been participating in it last year, and we hope the tradition can continue. And so we both run a discussion group on campus called EdDisco, and in that light, let me just hand it over to Deepti to kick us off today.
Thank you, Mark, and welcome, everybody. So yesterday and today, we have been hashing out emergencies in education and furthering our understanding by unpacking threads that stem from this umbrella. And we have been exploring how the concept of emergencies in education and education in emergencies evolve and change across and through organizations, individuals, different contexts. So to further this exercise and enrich this engagement even more, we have a panel discussion with a group of students coming from three different continents and four countries. And if we could move the slide. Yeah. So first, we will be hearing from participants a brief introduction, which will be followed by a sharing and a discussion of experiences and the embedded discourses. As we gear up for this session today, I want to first thank you all for joining us and then welcome you to share your experiences and questions in the third segment of this discussion. Now, I'd like to hand it over to Mark to go ahead from here.
All right. Thank you, Deepti. So our goal here really is to try to give students a voice and all as well us, right? So we have so many experiences of emergency in the room, and to hopefully help us broaden our definition of emergency, broaden our concept of emergency. And so I'd like to have the panelists just briefly introduce themselves, just a couple of sentences, each sort of sharing your name, your context, and what you are thinking of talking about today. And I'll start off with, I'll go in the order on the slides. So I'll start off with Diana.
Hey. Hi, everyone can hear me? Okay, I'm Diana. I'm from Peru, but actually I'm studying my master's degrees in Stockholm University in International and Comparative Education. So I have some experience in IB program. I was teaching, have been teaching there for 3 years and 7 years in secondary school too.
Thanks, Diana. And Simon online.
Hello, my name is Simon Zora Martin, a student of Kumi University pursuing diploma in agriculture. I'm South Sudanese by nationality, living in Bidibidi refugee camp in northern Uganda. I'm going to share with you my education experience in Bellevue Secondary School in Bidibidi refugee camp.
Thank you. And Milena.
My name is Milena. I'm from Greece. I'm a nursery teacher. Right now, I'm studying in Stockholm University in International and Comparative Education. And I'm going to share some experience that I have during the pandemic in the public nursery school. Thanks.
And Tabu online.
Hello, my name is Tabu Julius Alex. I'm a South Sudanese refugee living in Palorinya Refugee Settlement in Uganda. And I'm a second-year student pursuing a Bachelor of Science with Education in Kumi University. I will be sharing my experiences of the challenges of continuing education as a refugee student in a different cultural context.
Thank you. And then our final panelist, also online, Benjamin. And you are muted, Benjamin, if you are trying to talk. And possibly frozen. He did warn us that he was having an unstable internet connection this morning. So we will come back to Benjamin. No worries about that, Benjamin. And so what I would like to do is one final thing on the slides, and we will stop sharing. is we have an opportunity, we will hopefully have an opportunity at the end of this to have questions and answers. And so certainly we can hand the mic around if people want to share experiences, but we also have a poll service, Slido. There's no actual poll questions here, so it's not like you're going to be answering a multiple choice question. There's just going to be a box that has question. And so if, as you're hearing any of our panelists, if you would like to ask them a question, type it in there, and then keep that open because you can vote on everybody's questions. And that's how we're going to choose which questions to ask, is that we will take a look at those, the ones with the most thumbs up, that's what we'll get asked. All right. So without further ado, let me hand it over to Deepti to start us off with her questions.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark. So our first question is to Diana here. So Diana, could you begin with briefly sharing with us about your background? You said that you worked as a teacher in a rural context. So my question to you is that how did the challenges of being a rural teacher interact with COVID situation? And what was it like for you and for your students during that time? Yeah.
Thank you. Actually, I was working with IB program, the private school, but my interaction with the rural context is because our students in IB program were very connected with the rural students. Mm-hmm. So that's why I wanted to share today about the creativity of the Peruvian students and how they were very connected during this pandemic, because the government in that time we didn't have a stable plan for the education when the pandemic started. So that's why the government started to tell all the teachers in the private school to start one big project, because they say the government, the Minister of Education, they address the directors in the schools and they say that your teachers need to come to the channel because we will transmit our class in the national television. We were saying what? So it's like very surprise for us. And we started in that moment. My own experience as a teacher, it was like we needed to be in the side that we needed to support. We needed to support this problem. And we needed to have all the skills in that moment to be in front of the cameras, because in that moment we needed to record our classes. It was, in my case, was Spanish literature that I needed to transmit to in national television and with other college more. And I remember that it was very difficult for us because we didn't have time to repeat things. It was so quick. It even made me doubt about my own skills, my communication skills. It was very challenging for us as the teachers. Then I remember very clear that the students at home, because they couldn't leave their homes, and they needed to stay there with their parents, and their parents were very surprised because they say, oh my God, the teachers is our transmitters and transmitting in through the TV, and everyone, primary, preschool, primary and secondary school, they have their own schedule. And in the morning is kindergarten, afternoon is primary, and almost at night it was secondary school. It was like crazy for everyone, but it was like kind of mobility because the parents were very focused. The parents were at home. They couldn't work in the first months. So they were helping the children. They were with them all the time. Even sometimes, even when the children return to the school, they say that, I hope the pandemic continue now, because in that moment my parents were with me and we were together having a lunch together and talking about everything. They were helping me, and it was amazing time for them in certain point. But it was in general, but in the rural context it was having a problem because they didn't have signal, they didn't have connectivity, and we were struggling with that. So what can we do? It's like in one moment, it was like in the rural context, the people there needed to walk almost 2 hours from their houses because they needed to be with one phone that, as you see in the picture there, They needed to walk a lot and be with their parents because it's a little dangerous work, only children working alone. So they needed to try to find that signal, the connectivity to listen, because the transmission of it was on radio and the television, but from the case, because they didn't have televisions and other things, they needed to try to find. It was a very, very hard time for us as a country, because we could see this reality that was hit us in our face and telling us, this is your reality and do something about this. So that was very, very challenging for us. And the next thing, that very creative thing, we sometimes joke about this and say Peru doesn't conquer the world because we don't want. It's because the creativity is like amazing. Remember that I told you that there wasn't connectivity in that moment. There was areas where the signal didn't reach any parts. And in one situation, we were surprised in the news, even appeared that one teacher, a science teacher in the rural areas, built one robot. That robot contained music or lessons about language and maths or exercise, like kind of instructions that the little students could hear, because in those areas there wasn't teachers too, because they live very far away. So that teacher science built this kind of robot, and it was very nice for them because it's surprise for them, innovative for them, because the technology didn't arrive in those places yet. So even they couldn't carry the robot, they need to carry it with horses or the asnos that we say. So yeah, it was very, very creative for us, and were surprising because we could see in that moment that this reality of our country. Sometimes we are just blind of our own space, that because the public and a private school are very marked there. So this situation brought us together in this pandemic. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. And next, I would like to have Simon share some of your experiences from South Sudan. And you're currently studying at Kumi University in Uganda, having come to Uganda from South Sudan. So what would you like to share with us about emergencies in education from your perspective?
I came to Uganda in 2016. When I was 20 years old, because of civil war, which broke out in some parts of South Sudan in 2016, in 2013, and later spread through the whole country in 2016. On 3rd of September in 2016, I woke up very early in the morning. I went to school, from around 6 kilometers away from home. At around 11 a.m., a rebel group attacked my village when I was in school. So I was separated from my parents, of which I became worried of their lives, as I didn't know where they were, whether they were alive or not. So I and some students stayed in the school without knowing where our parents were, and our parents were also worried of our lives. We stayed in the school until the school administration decided to bring us to Bidibidi refugee camp in Uganda, because the situation was really terrible. Bidibidi refugee camp was the largest refugee camp in the world in early 2017. Up to now, I have not seen my parents, but I got their contract, so we are communicating. They are in South Sudan, and I am now in Uganda, staying with my aunt in the camp. So BDD refugee camp is having a refugee of 1.5 million. And it is a population of South Sudans living in refugee. There are about 61% of the population. And yeah, this is Bidibidi. The Bidibidi refugee camp in Uganda is home to about 2 million people, making it to the largest camp in the world in 2017. So up here is the camp, Bidibidi camp. Now, I would like to share about my education experience in Valley View Secondary School in Bidibidi refugee camp in Yumbe district of Uganda and the challenges. Few classrooms. We were over 1,000 students in a class. So for you to find a place to sit in the class, you had to come very early in the morning. And if you enter class, you have no option of getting out because the classroom was so compact and there was no space. There was no space for you to move around. Some students were peeping through the windows, standing from outside. So whether you are learning or not, the teacher doesn't know or care. The unspoken rule is that nobody owns a seat. That means if you get up from your place, someone immediately replaces you. Lack of teaching staffs and educational resources. There are very few teachers, and some subjects like chemistry and agriculture didn't have teachers to teach. So we had to buy our own textbook and voluntarily form a student group for discussion so that we may pass the final exams set by Uganda National Examination Board. Also, there was no laboratory for carrying out practical aspects of different subjects like agriculture, chemistry, biology, physics, and ICT. And yet, these are the compulsory subjects that we must do to get Ugandan certificate of education. All schools in refugee camp lacked teaching staffs and infrastructure to adequately prepare students for the national examination. Curriculum differences. In South Sudan, secondary schools ends in senior four, which specialization of whether you want to pursue science subjects or arts subjects starts in senior three. Meanwhile, in Uganda, secondary school ends in senior six, specialization is chosen in senior five. So when I was in South Sudan, I specialized in science subjects, but when I came to Uganda, I was forced to study both science and art, of which I got difficulties with the art subject. Psychological torture. When I was in the refugee school, I was traumatized whenever I saw some of the students who came from the tribe of the rebel leaders who attacked my village and killed many people, including my relatives. This was because we were all put in the same school, and it even reached to the extent we physically fought with those students. It was difficult to focus on learning with those whose family had killed my family. Financial struggles. It was very difficult for people living in refugee camps to afford school fees and registration fees. Most refugees decided to sell the ration provided by World Food Program to raise money for education. Also, as a refugee, it's extremely hard to find jobs in Uganda because you don't have citizenship. Education delay. The war in Uganda, in South Sudan, and the COVID-19 impacted my academic career and life prospects in such a way that by this time, I should have completed my bachelor's degree if I were to continue my studies in South Sudan. I would already be working because secondary schools ends in senior four in South Sudan, of which here in Uganda, it ends in senior six, which makes 2 years difference. In 2020, COVID-19 broke out, I was doing my first semester of diploma in university, and president announced a total lockdown in the country of a year and a half. All education came to a sudden stop, and I had to start from a scratch after the lockdown. My future aspiration, first and foremost, my biggest decision after finishing my studies is to give back to the refugee community by opening an orphanage school, farm, a health center. This is what I have seen my people are suffering with the most. Education, food, and health center is the basic need in the community. As during the war, many children lost their parents, and so many women became widows and single mothers. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Simon. I have rarely seen so many tears in an audience. I just wanted to let you know that everyone is hearing you. And I have reports, Sion Yang, another student here from JYU, has reported that there may be internet and power challenges. So the next, I would like to ask Tabu, who is also coming to us from South Sudan in Uganda, to share your experiences. You're also at Kumi University in Uganda, also coming from South Sudan. So what would you like to share with us today?
Okay, I will be sharing my experiences, challenges of continuing education as a refugee student in a different cultural context. We went to Uganda for refuge in January 2017, following a refugee settlement. Can see from there, it's one of the settlements in northern Uganda also. This was not my first experience of studying in Uganda. I was actually born in Uganda in the mid-1990s because my parents fled to Uganda due to a civil war that broke out in South Sudan. By then, it was called the Sudan. But my parents settled among the host communities bordering South Sudan due to rampant cases of cholera outbreak as a result of poor sanitation in the refugee camps during that time. I studied in a Ugandan primary school where most of the pupils were Ugandan nationals. Since I was able to speak the native language fluently, I didn't reveal my identity to the rest of the pupils for fear of being discriminated and harassed. But a few years later, when they found out that I was a South Sudanese, they sometimes denied me the opportunity to play with them. So I had to isolate myself, and sometimes I have to stay just alone. So, because they were making hate speech against me. For that reason, I constantly pressed my parents to return to South Sudan, but they said that it was too early for us to return because the situation in the country wasn't good at that time. There was no proper education in South Sudan, but later we partially shifted to South Sudan just a few years after signing of a peace agreement in 2005 to end over 20 years of civil war in the country that left many people dead. Later in 2014, we were forced to flee to South Sudan again due to a tribal conflict which broke out at the South Sudan and Uganda border between the communities living on either side due to a disputed borderline in which many houses belonging to South Sudanese refugees who were living among the host communities were burned down and many people were also killed. After I had went back to South Sudan, I thought hardship was over, and it was the moment I had been waiting for since childhood. Until 2016, when rumors of war started to spread, many youths started to disappear one by one, each and every day. And you ask yourself, where have they gone? Of course, many of them have joined the various rebel groups, and others have been abducted and killed, or forced to become child soldiers. South Sudan was no longer the lovely home I used to know. Certainly, only to realize that they have started to burn down houses and killing innocent civilians. Just within a few days, the situation intensified. It's hard to tell somebody how you are feeling about the situation. It was a difficult decision to make as a youth. One has to choose between returning to Uganda for refuge or joining the rebels in South Sudan. You don't know exactly what would happen to you and where your future lies. But one idea that flashed into my mind was that of going for further studies in Uganda. It seemed like a better choice. This made me follow my parents, who had already decided to return to Uganda, where I joined upper secondary education, or the advanced level. Life at school was not easy. You try to build your life again, but memories of losing your dear ones and your beautiful home continues to flash into your mind, and then tears begin to roll down your cheeks. You might be seated in a crowd, but still feels lonely and isolated. You only revise when in school, but when you return to the camp for holidays, you only revise during daytime because there is no light for you to use during the night. Even if the light is there, you can't revise because you are crowded in a small tent with the rest of the family members, both young and old. There was no proper shelter. Despite of the shortage of food, clean water, scholastics, clothing, proper shelter, and financial difficulties, and so on, I had to work hard to complete my upper secondary school level in 2018 because this was the only way to get out of that situation. The hope of continuing education worsened when COVID-19 broke out and the whole country was put under total lockdown. All educational institutions were closed for nearly 2 years. Many students gave up on education and resorted to drug abuse and gambling activities. And others found their ways back to South Sudan to work with the rebels. And a good number of girls dropped out of school due to pregnancy. After a long wait, educational institutions were later opened in October 2021. And I luckily got a full scholarship to study at Kumi University, one of the universities in Uganda. Otherwise, I didn't know the next move that I could have taken, perhaps a risky one. This is what many refugee youths went through, or even worse than this, during those times. I don't see anything bigger that takes this youth to carry guns other than the uncertainties about the future. You want to study, but the situation surrounding you cannot allow you to do so, because the future looks unclear. I'm totally convinced that the best weapon to break this cycle of conflicts is extending a helping hand to educate these youths, empower them so that they can be engaged in productive activities, other than allowing them to sink deeper and deeper into this mess. Please, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon and Tabu, for sharing your stories. They are a testament to how personal and political kind of define each other and shape each other. Now I'd like to turn to Milena here. And you come from a different context, Milena, and we would like to understand from you what changed about public nursery school education during COVID, and what were the student experiences And what did you see happening there as an educator?
Okay, I have to say that I've lost my words right now after these strong stories. Excuse me. Well, the first year of the pandemic, we have lockdown, and most of the time the nursery schools they were closed. I started to work in the nursery school in the middle of the schooling year of 2021. And it's something that actually happens a lot in Greece, which means that children, they have to adjust to new teachers all the time, which is, I think, problematic, especially for these ages. During the pandemic, I think that most of the teachers, we have lost our focus to the pedagogical work because we were so worried about what is going on if we get sick and what's the next introduction that the government will give to us. I mean, there were some introduction that they were anti-pedagogical. Don't touch, keep distance, don't touch each other, that we have to say to the children, to get the young children, which it's totally different for with what we have learned when we were be prepared to be educators. I worked mostly with infants, which is which was very demanding because I have to wear all the time my mask. And as a teacher, I use my voice as a pedagogical tool and also my facial expression in order to communicate with them. So we have this kind of difficulty. And at the same time, they are develop their social skills. So it's very questioning for me, and I think that maybe in some research in the future will reveal that it's not the best option to grow up when you see just part of the faces. I mean, if they saw us in the road without our mask, they couldn't recognize us. And that was one of the difficulty. Another difficulty is that we realized that we couldn't provide whatever they were missing because they missed a lot, even though they were with their parents, and parents probably they didn't care a lot to do pedagogical work with them. So we had to do it. But when we were when we had the mask, we couldn't speak clear, and they couldn't see our mouths, for instance, so they couldn't understand, and we couldn't help them to develop their linguistic skills. Something else that I would like to say is that during the pandemic, I think that little children, there were more than they should involved with technological achievements, which it wasn't very helpful, and it makes our work more demanding to take their focus to us. I'm sorry. But what I want to say mostly is that even though there were some changes in the pandemic, the biggest problem is that I realized that there is problematic situation in Greece in general. And that's what it was relieved because we saw teachers that they were more concerned about what we're doing with the mask, with the introduction, and we didn't pay so much attention in what is going on to their future. Thanks a lot. I'm sorry.
Thank you so much. We now, I'd like to introduce our final guest who is remote and his connection is back working again, we hope. So Benjamin, if you could take a moment just to introduce yourself and who you are.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mark. So my name is Benjamin Kwashi, and I am a student at the University of Education, Winneba in Ghana. And then I am also privileged to be a member of the School Improvement Coaches to help transform teaching and learning in Ghanaian schools. Currently a program developed by DTEL and the Ghana Education Service to help make schools learning centers.
Great. Thank you, Benjamin. And so you come to us from Ghana, having visited the University.
Hello, Mark. Can you hear me?
Are you back? Okay. Yes, we can. Are you back?
Hello, Mark.
Hey, I think you're back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we'll also, can maybe Benjamin, can you try turning off your video and we'll just have audio on audio here? Let's take 1 second here. All right, as we check with Benjamin here, I want to remind folks the
hello, Matt.
Great questions in Slido, so check that. If
hello, Matt.
Hello, Benjamin. Welcome back. Are you back?
Yeah.
Sorry about the network. Try turning off your video.
Sure. All right.
Great. So if you could share with us some of your experiences with education in emergency. I was explaining to the audience that you come to us from Ghana, having visited the University of Vivascula earlier this year. So you've experienced higher education during COVID in Finland and higher education and other levels of education in Ghana. So could you share, are there any parallels or any contrasts or interesting observations you'd like to share with us?
Yes, Mark, thank you very much. And once again, hi to all the participants in the audience. I would like to say that one of the many or few privileged persons who might have experienced education from different perspectives, growing up from a very remote area, I've experienced traditional learning with a lot of challenges. And then getting the opportunity to travel all the way to Finland, I've experienced what we can say is a blend of the traditional and the best practices in teaching and learning so far. So yeah, I'm privileged in that direction. I like to say that the Ghanaian experience during the COVID actually was surprising, or it came as a way of hitting the nation, just as it affected every other country around the world. Somewhere in March 12, 2020, we had our major cases being announced in terms of COVID, and then schools who had to be closed down somewhere in March 15. And then there was a decision after 3 months to get final year students back to school in June 2015. And so with that short space within 3 months, something that we've not been doing as a nation in terms of e-learning or online learning and combining that with blended mode of learning and all that will have to be organized, and then learners will have to keep learning in the midst of the COVID. So the final years were asked to go back to school, and it also came with its own challenges. But there are a few of the challenges I would like to highlight as Ghana was trying to get learning going on during the COVID era. One major challenge is what I call the techno illiteracy. And this one is on the part of both teachers and learners. Myself, I happen to be a teacher and a learner at the same time. So I have the both perspective of experience, having going through the challenges of learning as a student, and then myself going through the challenges of relearning or learning new things in terms of technology in order to keep teaching and learning going on, or helping my learners to also learn. So that was one of the key challenges. The second one has to do with the access to technological devices. We are in a country where a lot of people are underprivileged, and so even getting the finances to acquire the devices if you want them to come online and learn is one major challenge. Another challenge has to do with the internet connectivity. And even if you have access to the devices to support you in getting onto the online platforms to learn, you have challenge of internet connectivity. And a typical example is what I believe we have experienced now. I'm not having a stable network, and it's one of the biggest challenge in trying to do that. But in the midst of the challenges, there were some giant steps, you know, taking in order to get learning going on during the COVID time. And I must commend the government for its great efforts of collaborating with other private organizations and then bringing on board strategies in order to improve learning. I think one of the things that were done was the introduction of a program led by a company called Sendlos, that's the iBoss. And this program was able to help learners, because those in first year, second year, and then the basic, the primary schools were totally out of school. And so for a whole year, so this offline learning system known as iBox was able to help learners
we'll wait for
to one. Get offline television stations so that the learners can get in touch and keep in touch with learning throughout the COVID. Then also, there were other supports from the World Bank School Improvement Program, where installations of technological devices, like smart boards and projectors, were provided in some schools in order to help them keep learning going on. So these are some of the things that have been done. But I must also say that there is, in the midst of the COVID challenges, Ghana had already taken steps to transform the entire curriculum in the nation. And there is conscious efforts in improving teaching and learning, transforming teaching and also transforming the curriculum itself, reviewing it to standard based in order to help learners develop competencies that they need. Now, just opposing all that to the experiences that I had here in Ghana and also in Finland, I realized that in Ghana, we are not doing very bad. However, I must say that Finland is miles away ahead of Ghana in terms of modifying learning, which I experienced. Jyväskylä University, their Faculty of Education, where we have in this event right there, is one of the fascinating facilities that I have been to, and it allows for blended mode of learning. So whilst we in Ghana here is even having challenge with e-learning, Finland is actually doing blended hybrid learning and allowing both the traditional and then the online learning to merge together. And that is a very great experience to have had as someone who had my basic education from the remotest part of the country and with limited learning resources and all that. So it's a very great experience on that note. Now, there is something I would like to also talk about in terms of emergency. I've heard my colleagues from Uganda and the story is so touching. I am very much affected with that. But then there is another form of emergency which probably we are not looking at, and that has to do with pedagogy, if I want to put it that way, and managing the learning environment and making it more
Once again, we'll wait a second.
Flexible and friendly to learners. A care of proper punishment, which has learners going through some physical abuse and Hello, Mark.
Yes, I was just about to ask you. You cut out there for us a couple of times, so if you could maybe try to repeat.
All right. Yeah, thank you, Mark. So I was going to talk about another form of emergency that it's in a subtle way that probably we are not paying much attention to. And there are two of them. The first one is corporal punishment, which is prevalent in Ghanaian schools. And it is more of a societal or cultural kind of thing because we have different cultures and how we perceive things and religious blends and all that in the country. So as a nation, there isn't a firm conclusion on how corporal punishment should be dealt with. And it is to that extreme that parents could delightfully bring their children to school and ask that they be punished by giving some strokes or canes for them to be corrected morally or something like that. So that aspect is there, and I see it as a barrier to learning. It's an emergency that we need to pay attention to. We need to look at that holistically to deal with it, because a lot of children are going through these physical abuse and emotional abuse, which affects their learning. They want to opt out from the classroom. These factors are more of like push and pull factors, where learners are not finding the classroom attractive. They go away because there is some form of abuse. Meanwhile, the teachers are supposed to make learning the environment attractive and to attract the learners, pull them towards the learning environment instead of driving them away. The second one, which is also common in our tertiary institutions, is the fact that lecturers or university teachers are still providing their learners with handouts and teachers selling handouts, course manuals to learners in a way as having some kind of psycho-emotional corporal punishment on the learners, because you know that this is your teacher, he's selling a course outline, and then there is a list for these learners to write their names when they buy the course outline. Write their names, write their index numbers. And the teacher is the determinant of your score or your assessment. And so you know the implication, what it means not to buy that course manual. But the question is that course manual the only learning material available that can help learners to achieve the competencies we want them to achieve? Why should learners be coerced to get a particular course manual from a specialty their teacher? So these two factors are strong pull and push factors that we need to look at in our education as emergency, especially in Ghana. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.